It's Let's Talk Legal on the Talk Station FM 107.1. And joining us this afternoon, we have Cecil Harvell of Harvell and Collins. And as always, to remind you, the number 252 area code 726-9050. 726-9050. And of course, online at Harvell and Collins. And I mention this every week, spell out the word and, harvellandcollins.com. And with that, good afternoon, Cecil.
Good afternoon, Lockwood. Wes is in a jury trial today, so he cannot join us. But here I am, and here you are, and we're going to have a nice conversation. You know, Lockwood, last week we discussed the topic that has gone up, by the way, on the website and on our Facebook page and Instagram page. The topic last week was, what is a trust?
Right.
Why do I need one? Do I need one? And so I thought that this afternoon, one week later, we would really go back to basics and say, what is a last will and testament? And do I really need one? And why do I need one? And so, Lockwood, there's a lot of confusion around just a straightforward last will and testament. For instance, just right out of the gate, I think about all the time when clients come in, they have their consultation with me, I then quote their attorney fee. Almost 99% of the time, they proceed that very moment. But one of their questions is, well, now what do you need from me, Cecil? What do you need me to list down all of my accounts and my CDs and my stocks or bonds, my cars, the VIN numbers on my trailer for my boat? I mean, don't you need all of this information? The account numbers at the bank.
Right.
And Lockwood, isn't it just fascinating that my answer is, Mr. and Mrs., I don't need a thing. I needed your full names, and I need the full names of your children and or your other beneficiaries, and I need to solicit who your executor will be and things of that. But in terms of your assets, I do not need a listing of those things to, quote, put into or insert into your last will and testament. Now, I would love to have that information in the back of the file. It's confidential, and it can stay in the back of our office file in your name so that if, God forbid, something were to happen, it's a place where the children can start and or your executor. But, Lockwood, here we go. Those things are always changing. I mean, Wells Fargo used to be Wachovia.
Right.
Truist used to be, BB&T, wasn't it? I can't keep up with them all. They're all great banks,
but they all have new
Change. Names now.
Yes.
Okay, there have been so many mergers. Account numbers change. Even our brokerage companies, are named differently than they used to be. Our cars and vehicles, of course, Lockwood, come and go. You might have this vehicle now, but in 5 years or 10 years, it would be a different vehicle. Even your real property can change so as to enumerate, 2907 ABC Street. Well, we might not be living in 2907 ABC Street. So the duty of the last will and testament is to say that I hereby direct my executor to marshal together all of my assets, land, personal property, tangible property, whatever they happen to be, whatever I happen to have in my personal life, and I ask you to gather it all together and then distribute it pursuant to the distribution provisions in this, my last will and testament, which might be 100% to my spouse, and then, a third, a third, and a third to my three children, or, half to my child and half to my church, or half to my child and half to a particular charity.
Mm-hmm.
And so the bottom line is that the information that we need to prepare a well-drafted last will and testament is more the family situation, the relationships in the family, the names, the full names, and, of course, also the distribution intent, the decisions that the family have made or the testator has made relative to the distribution. So right out of the gate here, we talk about the fact that the last will and testament does not mention all of these particular details as to assets, and really should not, Lockwood. Another common denominator question to this topic of naming all of the particular assets is naming all the teaspoons. Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk about my grandmother's silver. I want to talk about, you know, my my Oriental rug. I want to talk about my Charles McNeil. That's a good name, isn't it,
right.
Lockwood?
Yep.
And I want to talk about my collection of Charles McNeil watercolors, uh-huh. Okay? Well, these are all wonderful, tangible things, things that we can touch and feel. And what we do is that we mention in the will that there is a memorandum that I will write in my handwriting concerning my tangible personal property, my okay. collections, my particular family heirloom, china, or antique, or art, or whatever it might be, and I direct my executor to distribute according to this memorandum. Now, the reason that we have a memorandum versus encumbering the will with all of these tangible property provisions is that many times tangible property, Lockwood, you know, will really come and go.
Uh-huh.
Mothers have a way of giving their jewelry on to their children or their little granddaughters before before they die, or, you know, downsizing the house, and a lot of the family heirlooms, you know, go on to the children or grandchildren. And so as folks get older and older, these things are not still in their possession. And when you put them in the last will and testament, then you set up a scenario where the clerk of court is going to want to see a receipt
uh-huh.
on those things.
Okay.
We have this identical file in our office right now where a lady left a particular ring. She had several rings, but this particular ring, you know, she described it, and in her will, which is not what I recommend,
mm-hmm.
and she left it to a particular, well, it can't be found. It can't be located. And so the beneficiary, of course, is very disappointed because they didn't, even though the will says that they're to get this particular ring, it cannot be located. And so you remember the old adage, Lockwood, what we all have in common is to avoid costs,
mm-hmm.
to avoid excessive lawyering,
mm-hmm.
to avoid taxes, to avoid delay. Well, this little problem over this, quote, ring has created all of those issues. What was the value? What more lawyer fees? How do we get the beneficiary to understand that it cannot be located and that therefore she will not get it, and she releases the estate from any further liability as a result of not being able to receive this, quote, ruby ring? So, there's a point, Lockwood. There's where the devil is in the details. We do not want to encumber the will with all of these mentionings of tangible personal property because many times they just simply are not there when we finally pass on.
That's a very interesting scenario. I had not even considered that. We're talking with Cecil Harvell of Harvell and Collins. We're talking about a last will and testament. And, of course, we're going to be continuing this conversation. I know that everybody should have a last will and testament. But as you've just pointed out, Cecil, let's be very careful about what we put in that last will and testament. That is an interesting dilemma. And by getting into the details, as you said, the devil's in the details. But once you get into the details and they become codified, that's my description, you can correct me on that, then it becomes a real issue, a very
Correct.
Expensive issue. That's impressive. I hadn't even considered that.
I also find, Lockwood, that the real skill of the lawyer
mm-hmm.
helping a client put together a last will and testament is in these details that we're talking about. And the structure, and here we go with a biggie, which is the word contingent.
Mm-hmm.
I just cannot tell you how many problems we have in our office because the last will and testament did not have enough contingencies. Now, what do I mean by that? First of all, yes, we're going to name an executor, but we have to name an alternate to that executor. You know, we can name our spouse if we have one, but then we have to name who's next. And then I like to see even, if you will, a contingent to the who's next. So there would be three designees, particularly between husband and wife. Just yesterday, I had a lady in the office who was having to change her will because her husband has become frail and infirm, mm-hmm. and she knows that if anything happened to her, he would not be able to be the executor. Right. Now, fortunately, they have named their a daughter, but that daughter is fighting, you know, a cancer, if you will. And the point just is that we need to have backups. We need to have alternates. And this is something that, you know, clients are always so excited about telling me who their executor is going to be. And then when I ask them, well, now who will be the executor if John cannot be the executor? Right. There is many times, you know, Lockwood, kind of a blank stare. Right. Well, we haven't thought about that. Well, guess what? The client doesn't have to think about that. That's the responsibility of the lawyer to think about that and to ask those questions and to get those answers. And sometimes it's a matter of me saying at that point, well, there's no rush. You all think about that and then call me in a day or two or next week and let me, or email me, or let me know who the alternate is. But, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Jones, we are going to need another alternate. This comes up, of course, as one can only imagine, when there's only one child. Parents would name each other and then the one child, and they think that's enough. Well, it's not enough, okay? Now, that's just the executorship. How about the beneficiaries? Wow. You know, we've got three children. Well, what happens if one of the children is no longer living?
Uh-huh.
What then happens? Okay. And some people say, well, I want it to go, I assume that it goes to my child's spouse. Well, that's not a correct assumption. Okay. It doesn't go to the spouse of the of your child, unless you direct that it does. Well, I assume it goes to my children. Well, it, again, an assumption. You cannot assume that. It doesn't necessarily go down the lineal line. It might go to the other surviving children. Mm-hmm. So there can be ambiguity here, Lockwood. And what does ambiguity cause? It causes more lawyers, right, more time, more delay, more expense. And so it's very important that you retain a lawyer that has a lot of experience in this area who is going to guide you. You know, the word we lawyers get called counselors. Well, mm-hmm. this is more counseling than really lawyering. It's both, of course, but the bottom line is we're leading the client by asking these questions so that these contingencies get addressed in the document. Who are the contingent beneficiaries? Who are the contingent executors? And the ultimate contingency, which fortunately I've got quite a few clients who do bring this issue up, and I'm always impressed when they do. They say, "We look, you know, we have our two children, but we are on trips all the time, and we, you know, just went to Italy together, mm-hmm. and we're just traveling together. What if something happens to all of us? What then?"
Right.
You know, Cecil, and so there needs to be a provision in the will about this catastrophic circumstance, and under those conditions, who then would be the beneficiaries? So, lots of attention needs to be in the discussion of contingencies.
You know, we're talking with Cecil Harvell and of Harvell and Collins, and I think the important aspect of our conversation today on the last will and testament, and Cecil, you hit on some really important aspects of this, and that is the problem of assumption. And I'll narrow it down to that for our audience. Don't hesitate to call Harvell and Collins at 252 area code 726-9050 to avoid unnecessary expense and damage, I might add, by making assumptions. As Cecil is just sharing with us here on the issue of last will and testaments, we cannot assume anything. This is what he does. He targets the specific issues. You know, Cecil, I've heard the term first to die in wills. Mm-hmm. And what does that have to do with, you know, the distribution of assets and things of this nature? Is there an issue there?
Well, usually that phrase is in reference to spouses, where the last will and testament is talking about, well, this is what happens when the first of the two of us die. Mm-hmm. Upon the death of the first spouse, the following happens. And then when the second spouse, upon the death of the second to die, that is Lockwood legal language. It's not too hard to understand. Upon the death of the second to die, which would be when both mother and dad have died, both spouses have died, then the following occurs. And so that is some of the language that we use to structure up, if you will, the disposition.
Okay.
This is what happens upon the first to die. This is what happens upon the second to die. And so that's good language. A couple of other basic things that come up is folks are concerned about the fact that, well, you know, Cecil, I did a will 7, 8, 10 years ago. It's up in, you know, New Jersey, or I did a will, you know, over in Western North Carolina before I moved here to, you know, God's country,
right.
Beaufort.
Right.
Well, and what do I do about that will that I did sign, you know, years ago? And the answer to Lockwood is a good one, which is that your will immediately starts out with, I hereby revoke all prior wills and codicils made by me. And so the will that you did years ago, wherever it would happen to be, is revoked by the will that you are signing today. And again, some clients don't know this. And so we lead them through the answer to that question, things of that nature. But we sometimes they will gather up their old will. They've already done that before they come to the appointment or that kind of thing. But the bottom line is that the will revoke the prior will. Okay. Even so.
Now, the other aspect of this, of course, if a will is written in another state, the assumption here might be that, and it was just written last month or late last year, the assumption is that it's when I move to North Carolina that it'll apply to my estate here. Is that a good assumption? First question. I go back to my term assumption. And the second question is, if it does not, How do you determine, well, for example, where the individual is domiciled, things of that nature, because I'm sure
right.
that plays a role in how the will is probated.
Yeah. Well, the answer to that question is that the last will and testament is going to be looked at in the state of North Carolina to see whether or not it conforms to the state of North Carolina law.
Okay.
In other words, is it signed? Does it have witnesses? Is it potentially under notary? What are the terms? Is it clear and unambiguous? Things of that nature. If the New Jersey will or the New York will conforms to these requirements, then North Carolina will accept the will. The problem, however, though, Lockwood, is that the New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania will is going to then incorporate in the document the statutes of that particular state where mm-hmm. it was signed. And so it can now be a conflict of laws question. And what happens is that even though the will is admissible, even though the will, you know, is potentially controlling, that will is going to kind of go in the B stack because it doesn't incorporate the North Carolina statutes. It's incorporating the New York or the Pennsylvania statutes. And that then puts us again, as we've said now three or four times today, this afternoon, Lockwood, in our great discussion, that then now here we have the lawyers. Here we have the delay,
right.
Here we have the excessive cost. We have all of the things that all of we, me included, you included, want to avoid,
right,
relative to the settlement of our state. Clients are flabbergasted when they bring in their documents from another state, and I tell them this, and then I peruse through the document and go to page 12 or 14 or 15, and it says right there, clear as a bell, I hereby direct my executor to administer my state consistent with Pennsylvania statute, yada, yada, yada,
uh-huh,
with New York statute, yada, yada, because all well-drafted wills do incorporate the laws of the state where they were signed.
Mm-hmm.
And so clients like, gosh, I never saw that. I never realized that. So, again, the word assumption comes into play here, too, doesn't it?
Oh, yes, it does. And we've got a lot of people who are relocating here, as you just said. This is, God's country. And in the process, they're bringing with them all their documents, assuming that their documents are solid. But
here.
Very good point.
A lot to do.
Yeah. All right. So
okay. I just mentioned, Lockwood, as we talked this afternoon, that North Carolina requires two witnesses or witnesses,
mm-hmm,
I think I said.
Right.
We get three. Again, the word contingency. What if one of the two is no longer,
yes,
not is no longer living or is frail, infirm? So we do get three witnesses in our law firm almost always. I would say 99.9% of the time. Sometimes when we have to go to the hospital to have a will signed, or we have to go to the home place to have a will signed, or the skilled care facility, then we only will take two witnesses, because here comes the clincher. These witnesses need to sign the presence of a notary. So if you have three witnesses and you have a notary, that's four people, four, mm-hmm, human beings that, mm-hmm, walk into the room at the time of the signing of the will.
Right.
Almost all clients every day get a real chuckle out of that. They say, well, you know, where's the tea and crumpets? I mean, we didn't know we were going to come to a party here, Mr. Harvell, you know, because it's just me and the client, and then all of a sudden we're ready to sign the document, and in comes this parade of people.
Right.
Four people, Lockwood, okay? Now, three is three witnesses and one notary. This plays into the question that I get, unfortunately, too frequently, which is that, well, Cecil, can you just send me the will?
Uh-huh. Okay,
just put it in the mail to me, and I'll get it signed. Okay,
right.
We don't do that. That is maybe even potentially beneath the standard of care.
Right.
You do have to explain at that point to the client that, well, Mr. Jones, that just is going to be very, very difficult, because let me explain why.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're going to need to find two witnesses and a notary. By the way, Lockwood, they all have to be in the room at the same time and at the same moment,
mm-hmm,
that you set your signature on the page. So if the signing of this will is not done properly, then here we go again. Lawyers, delay, problems, potentially even the will being set aside.
Uh-huh.
For instance, this person who just said, well, just send me the will in the mail, and I will get it signed. They might then sign it, go take it to their neighbor and say, here's my signature, witness it. Go take it to the neighbor on the other side and get the other signature, and then go find a notary somewhere to say, we'll notarize it. Well, that will is not valid. That is not following the requirements of the North Carolina law relative to the way in which a will is to be, and the word is a terrible word, executed. But that's kind of a bar exam,
right,
word, isn't it? The execution of a will is that the testator, the signer of the will, signs it in the presence of at least two witnesses, in the presence of these two witnesses and with a third notary witnessing those signatures. So is the witness standing down the hall in the presence? What does that mean?
Right.
There probably, Lockwood, are 100,000 cases in the United States of America addressing the issue of in the presence of the testator.
Wow.
Okay?
Yeah.
Because you know, the witness was down the hall.
Mm-hmm.
The witness came in a moment later. The witness got interrupted by a phone call and left the room. All of these kinds of things. So it's very important that you're with a lawyer who knows these requirements and that adheres to them to the letter of the law. We are incredibly careful at our office concerning the issue that you and I are talking about right now. When we get ready to sign a will, absolutely the staff at our office knows it's time to come into the room
and
pay attention, watch the testator sign, witness the will, and the notary observes the entire process. Because if that, they all potentially would be witnesses in a case if the will for any reason were challenged.
Okay. That, and I wondered why you wanted a third witness, and that is in case of a challenge. Am I correct on that?
That's right.
Okay. Because we've talked about this in the past, finding a witness in a particular case, and whether it's be a case related to a will or some other incident, is quite often difficult, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And so, anyway, interesting program today, Lockwood, over things that a lot of people would think are just very, very basic. And they are basic, but they're basic as long as they get addressed.
Understood. And of course, as you've just pointed out numerous times, the great error is an error of assumption. We're assuming that we have these structures in place, and you ask those questions. That's the purpose of contacting Harvell and Collins. And again, want to remind you, 252 area code 726-9050, and go online to harvellandcollins.com. As always, Cecil, thank you for your time this afternoon on this issue, particularly important issue of last will and testament. Thank you for your time.
Okay, thanks, Lockwood.
Let's talk legal on the talk station.